The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening. You are listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. We are back. We have had a bit of a hiatus, about 2 weeks, but in the studio with me this evening is Matt, our movie guy.
Hello.
And Vicky, back by popular demand.
Thank you very much.
Just my demand, really.
Yeah, no, just you. Yeah. You're popular, though, so it's sort of, like, has some kind of indirect...
Cheers, buddy.
Yeah, thanks.
So, coming up on the show this evening, we have an SH play for you. We're going to be doing some reviews. I'm going to be talking about something that I saw a couple of weeks ago. Matt's going to be talking about something he saw a couple of weeks ago. We're also going to be talking about the excitement last night. That was Eurovision, so stay tuned for that. But first this evening, this...
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Oh, Matt, I've missed you so much.
I've missed being here. And it's official that we're fortnightly now, right, isn't it?
Yes, that is correct. So we are going down from a weekly show to a fortnightly show. So next week, from 6 till 7, you'll be hearing a show called The Cheese Board, which I've been told is the show that's taking our place every second week.
Will there be cheese? Do we know?
I don't know. If there is, I'm coming.
Yeah, we'll just turn up anyway.
I'm not really sure what the show is, and I'm not sure if it started yet. They might have started last week, but I'm not entirely sure, but I need to chat to them.
But in any case, Blackshaw Arts Hour, quality, not quantity.
Yes, that's what we're striving for at the moment, is all quality theatre-produced stuff. Anyway, let's go straight into what are you doing, Matt, for us today?
Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, yeah.
By director George Miller. It's the fourth Mad Max movie, first in very many years. I haven't seen any of the other three. Have you?
No,
I haven't.
I feel like a bad Australian.
I've been informed that it doesn't have any impact on your enjoyment of the film.
You don't. I haven't seen any of them, and it didn't affect whether I understood what was going on.
I've seen a lot of Facebook statuses asking the question: do I need to see Mad Max 1 to 3 to see the new one?
I kind of want to now.
Yeah,
sort of, but no, it's not a complicated setup or a complicated plot. Basically, it's the far future. We're in a desert wasteland. Everything is horrible. Everybody's got cancer and general weird mutations. Resources are scarce, and if you control them, then you control people effectively. So the world is sort of divided into bands of a warlord who's got all the resources and all the people following the warlord. What happens in this one is the Imperator Furiosa. There are lots of names like this in this movie.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
Imperator Furiosa is Charlize Theron's character. She is a trusted general of Immortan Joe.
So good.
I know. Who is disgusting. And he is one of these aforementioned warlords. Furiosa makes off with Immortan Joe's giant war lorry and his entire harem of wives.
Ah, I can imagine that causes some problems.
And yes, and he chases them across the desert. And in the course... and she's trying to take them to safety with the motorcycle matriarchy that she was stolen from as a child.
I am confused already.
But also, I'm quite excited.
But effectively, it's a big car chase for an entire movie.
Okay.
And along the way, she accidentally acquires, through a series of weird circumstances, Mad Max Rockatansky from the previous films, now no longer played by Mel Gibson, but played by Tom Hardy instead.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Just putting that out there. Sorry.
I do not take offence to that whatsoever.
And also randomly picks up a guy called Nux, played by Nicholas Holt, who is one of our own, a good old Brit. Well, as is Tom Hardy, of course. Nicholas Holt, who you might know from About a Boy ages ago or from X-Men more recently. And so they sort of end up tagging along for the ride, but Charlize Theron's character is definitely the one driving everything. So it's not an especially sophisticated movie. It's a big car chase in post-apocalyptic wasteland with lots of tricked-out, rusty cars with circular saws and all sorts of things on them. Lots of explosions, lots of... weird, horrible, grotesque, horrifying makeup jobs, and lots of chasing and blowing things up and shooting and all of that stuff. And yet it's getting all of these, you'll have noticed by now, because it's been out for a couple of weeks, it's getting these rave reviews, which is partly, I think, because it clears some very low bars. It's a weird thing. Like, it doesn't do anything particularly groundbreaking, but it avoids a lot of the pitfalls that so many Hollywood action blockbusters fall into. So it avoids the shortchanging women pitfall, because it's got several interesting, differentiated women in it, and the whole plot is driven by Charlize Theron's character. She's the one making all the decisions. Everyone else is kind of just along for the ride. It avoids that boring action pitfall. We've talked before on this show about sort of action direction, and I know, Vicky, you talked about John Wick and the way that they direct the action in that as compared to, for instance, Jupiter Ascending, and this sort of trend at the moment towards these ridiculous sort of lots of very fast cuts and close-ups that just leave you not really aware of what's even going on the screen. Whereas, John Wick did something different with that, with lots of sort of wide shots, and this strikes a really nice balance between sort of the wide shots that will show you the relationship between everything on the screen, and also put everything in the context of this massive wasteland, and so which kind of makes all of the struggles that they're going through seem so sort of small and insignificant, but also getting a bit close up close and personal and in your face, and making you really feel like, you know, that blow is coming at you. And that kind of thing, and it clears the lazy ending bar. You know, this isn't Waterworld. There's no
oh, that film.
Yeah, I know, man. But like, that's such a, you know, the utopia is there, dangled all the way through, and then they find it, and then, you know, dull. Whereas this takes a much sort of more difficult, less predictable approach to the end. And I just feel like it gives the... And it's just fun all the way through. It's a really well-executed example of a kind of dumb, like, simple but effective action blockbuster. And it gives the lie to the excuses that we hear over and over again from Hollywood people. You're like, oh, no, you've got to do it this way, because otherwise it won't sell, people won't see, it won't get made, and if it does get made, people won't watch it if you don't do this, that, and the other. And I just think it... George Miller has bothered to avoid some very obvious pitfalls that have been sort of well identified by movie criticism, and it just goes to show how kind of it, I don't mean to do George Miller down or anybody involved in the movie, but it just shows that it doesn't take a huge amount of effort really to differentiate your movie from the mass of others that are out there. I think that the single misstep, if it does have one, is that it does fall into that thing of the most sort of normal and non-ugly looking people are the heroes. So sort of defining the bad guy, like the more deformed, the more obviously sort of cancerous and mutated somebody is, the more likely they are to be a bad guy in this. But equally, the good guys do all have, you know, like they're not unaffected by the horrible future that they're in. Furiosa is missing an arm. Nicholas Holt's character has he has a couple of cancerous lumps that he has drawn faces on and named in a lovely bit of gallows humour. And Tom Hardy is the Mad Max himself is the most normal looking person, but he's obviously got some stuff going on the inside.
Oh yeah, one of those
that kind of
guys.
Marks him out. Yeah,
it sounds like a mixture of The Hills Have Eyes. And what Mad Max sort
it
of
is a little bit,
was.
Yeah, mutant hillbillies.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's Max like? I'd like to know what's his sort of, what's he doing? What's his accent doing, more importantly?
Tom Hardy's accent is always a bit odd. Like, I couldn't quite tell whether he was going for an Australian accent or not. But the reason it's difficult to tell is because he hardly speaks.
Yeah, well, someone that I know has seen it, and they said that there's about 15 lines in the entire film, I find incredible.
Max spends half the movie with a muzzle on.
Oh, does
so
he?
He can't speak Bane styles. For a little bit. Yeah.
I feel like this is Tom Hardy at his finest, though. It's actually that I always think
muzzled.
Yeah, he does a really good job of, like, he does good eye acting, which, as you guys know, I'm a big fan of.
Yes.
People who are good at eye acting. But I always feel like Tom Hardy does voices. He just doesn't necessarily do voices that you might expect the character to have. But you're still like, that voice is incredible, Tom Hardy. How have you achieved this? And he's like, oh, I've mixed together three different types of accent that I thought of, and I came up with this thing.
It's like he's coming up with new colours.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah. Like, he's just gone, yeah, this thing, and you're like, okay, we'll go with
that before, but
let's go with it. And I just think that's part of his creativity as an actor, is like he did with Bane. So I'm kind of excited to
witness
this.
He is good, though. Like, the, you know, he not saying things is not a mark of sort of not doing much with your character. I feel like that all the characters are quite broadly drawn. You know, Mad Max is, he says right at the beginning in a monologue, he's reduced to one instinct, the will to survive. And part of the story of the movie is him finding something else to as a purpose, not just surviving at all costs, but finding something else to believe in. And Furiosa's arc is pretty much she's fed up with how horrible everything is and is going to try and do one good thing. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be so. One of the things that this movie has got for itself going in the news is that somebody picked up. That it seems to be annoying some internet misogynists.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm sure if you dig deep enough on the internet, you can find people hating on absolutely anything. But this seems to have sort of caught people's attention and gone in and become viral and got into the news. That there are people saying, this is supposed to be a Mad Max movie. It's supposed to be a movie about dudes shooting and driving cars. And what are all these women doing in it?
I can't believe that at the moment we're upset about that. How are we upset? Come on, people.
Nobody is. It's a small corner of the internet.
It's like three people. Yeah. It's just three guys making
people.
A lot of noise.
Oh, they need to leave.
But I don't know about you, but I was quite excited by the trailers. They're really well put together and made it look really fun. But it was when I heard horrible internet misogynists hate this movie that really made me actually want to see it. I was wondering whether, because there have been things in the past as well with sort of religious nuts denouncing Harry Potter for being Satanist and all these sorts of things, like whether you've ever gone to see a movie almost specifically to spite somebody who hates it.
I feel like Vicky's definitely done that.
Oh, I probably do that all the time. I just do that to my boyfriend Dave, if I'm honest. I've gone to see movies where I think a lot of people, they say like, oh, well, this movie had this one flaw and that made me hate the whole thing. And I like to be a bit kind of like, well, I'm going to see it anyway, you know. Mm. I want to experience it for myself. I don't want to be told whether I'm going to like something or not. Sometimes I see films that I know I'm going to hate just because it'll be really fun to hate on them while I'm watching them and then hate on them afterwards. Like, I watched the first Twilight movie for that exact reason, and it was as bad as I'd expected it to be, and I kind of enjoyed it for that reason.
I think I do that with those trashy kinds of things. I'm really interested in, like, I watched Katy Perry's film the other day, and I watched it because I knew that my partner wouldn't want to watch it, and that gives me a sense of I got something over you. But it was so good. And same with like One Direction, like films where, like, you know, those films made for kids, I love that. I love it, and I love that other people hate it, and I love putting them, like, making them sit through it, because it's just like, how heartwarming is it, guys? If you don't feel anything in this, you are dead inside.
Also, like, you're not allowed to have an opinion about something until you've seen it.
Yeah.
And that seems to be one of the things people are rebelling against with these internet stories, is a lot of the people who are railing against Mad Max don't seem to have actually watched it yet. And so, you know, the narrative they're trying to construct is this is a feminist screed, and the main message of the movie is men must submit. But I think that if the movie even has a message other than let's watch some cars blowing up, it's actually almost an optimistic message, because it's that even if the world is that messed up and we have no resources and everybody's mutated, there are still lines that some people won't cross. And that it's the fact that this Immortan Joe warlord he treats people as property, so he has Max captive to use as a blood effectively a walking blood transfusion for his soldier boys, and he has his wives who he treats as property, and sort of all his soldiers and everyone, and it's Furiosa rebelling against that and saying, no, actually, I can't stand for that. That drives the whole movie. And so if it does have a message, it's slavery is bad. Which, again, as I've said all the way through, it's not a complicated movie with complicated morals, but it is really well pulled off and just, steers clear of so many traps so skillfully that I think it sets a new, slightly higher, but sort of significantly noticeably higher bar for these kinds of Hollywood movies.
Wow. You're going to see it tomorrow, aren't
you? I am going to see it tomorrow. I'm excited to see it tomorrow.
I really want to see it as well, just to see what these people are saying about, you know, these misogynists. Come on now. I don't understand how you can get that from this.
I think it is because, as I said, Max is kind of there along for the ride, whereas Charlize Theron's character is the one that's actually driving the movie, literally, for a lot of the case.
She's actually driving
the movie. They're probably just upset about the idea of a woman behind the wheel of a car more than anything.
Yeah.
So.
But as far as, like, as I said, I haven't seen the previous movies, but as I understand it, that is his role in those as well. He sort of rocks up to a situation and is the kind of the witness or the, like, the audience eyes on that situation and then leaves at the end. So it's not, it sounds like, I would have to watch the other movies to tell, but it sounds like it's not that different to the previous ones in that sense, in the sense that he doesn't really have a driving role in the plot.
Interesting. Would you rate that more than Fast and the Furious 7?
I would.
Oh, good.
Yes.
It's good. We're getting some sort of...
Yeah, I like this comparability study thing that you're doing.
We've
here.
Done Part enough nine. Now to have some comparisons.
Partly
in
because in Fast and Furious 7, I felt a little bit like I ought to maybe know what some of the cars were, whereas these are all like far future sci-fi fantasy cars. So I don't.
The best kind of cars.
Yeah, with circular saws and things. They
Why
don't
not?
Have that in Fast and
no,
the Furious.
No, of course they don't.
What are you thinking of doing anything for, not next week, but the week after, obviously, because we're going to fortnightly as a show.
So it's more difficult when it's fortnightly looking ahead, but I Pitch Perfect 2 is out at the moment. I really want to see that because I quite enjoyed the first one. There's a few more coming out. So the big movies for the next couple of weeks are San Andreas with The Rock, which is a big disaster movie about the San Andreas fault going.
Oh, I'm so excited to see that. I love disaster movies.
We will have to go and see that because my other half loves The Rock. Okay. Like, he's got.
I think
that's going to
be.
I think
we should definitely.
Yeah. So that could happen. That could happen.
There's also the week after that. There's Spy with Melissa McCarthy. Oh, who, yeah. I like her, and the trailer, when I think they trailed it before Mad Max, and I laughed a good sort of 6 or 7 times in the trailer alone, so I feel that that will probably be worth a watch as well.
Yeah, she's fully hilarious, so...
Well, good. Well, we've got some stuff in the bag that we can draw on for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, keep us posted. What do you want me to review?
Yes, I am definitely up for a disaster movie San Andreas. That's my pick. Anyway, we are going to move into our arts thing of the week now. And Vicky's in the studio this time, so we're not going to listen to her doing a pre-record. She's actually going to tell us about a thing, and it's one of the most excited Okay, let's try and speak properly.
You're just that excited, aren't you?
I'm so excited. I can't even speak about how excited I am about Eurovision. Vix, come on.
Eurovision is my third favourite day of the year after Christmas and Pancake Day. I've always loved Eurovision ever since I was a kid. When I lived at home with my mum and dad, we would get together as a family and watch it. My dad is a massive fan of Eurovision. My sister loves Eurovision, although she's unfortunately in the States this weekend, so she's missed it. And I know she's a bit gutted about that, even though she's on holiday. And I've got several reasons that I love it, which I'm just going to briefly run through now, but they're also the things that I think make for a really great Eurovision entry. And of course, it was the 60th anniversary this year. So it's been running for a long time. In fact, it's just won the Guinness World Record for the longest running music competition on television uninterrupted for 60 years. So some of the things that I love about Eurovision are firstly, just the kind of utter fabulousness of the whole experience. It's incredibly theatrical. Songs are intended to be kind of theatrical performances, and last night there were several that kind of really fell into that category. They're normally incredibly flamboyant stage shows with a bigger and better lighting and kind of projection effects and crazy costumes and things every single year. It's absolutely incredible the kind of step change increase in quality that you see year on year at Eurovision. It's unlike, and like, they must have to create these special stadia that can kind of,
for a given value of quality.
Yes. Oh yeah.
A specific kind of quality.
Yes, it's very specific kind of quality. I mean, in terms of like the kind of the amount of money they're having to pour in to do things like light effects and flying people in and crazy projections and people disappearing literally on stage. I've not even been able to work out how that happened, and all kinds of stuff like that. That's just unlike anything you you would see in an ordinary stage show, and it is quite an incredible thing. And then there's all the really kind of perfect gimmicks that have been developed throughout the kind of Eurovision legacy of things like rip-off costumes, of which you're going to see one at least in every single Eurovision competition, and then all these perfect little awkward postcards that they do before each performance of something happening in the home country. So bad. They're so bad. It's amazing. And that's, I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I get a kind of real enjoyment out of things that are so bad they're good. And Eurovision is the perfect embodiment of something that is so bad it's good. And since the invention of Twitter, it's, I think, is even better, because if you're on Twitter at the same time, you're just seeing everybody experiencing the same thing in exactly the same way across the whole of Europe, not just the United Kingdom, and actually Australia as well.
Yeah, good morning, Australia.
How many times did that happen?
So many times.
It's like they couldn't wrap their heads around the idea.
Oh, it's so exciting
that Australia's in a totally different time zone to, I don't even know.
Wow, mind-blowing.
Absolutely mind-blowing. And there are all kinds of kind of wonderful aspects to Eurovision, and I'm sure a lot of people will have enjoyed those last night. But as it was the 60th anniversary, of course, there was a special guest, as we've just mentioned, at Eurovision last night, which was the continent of Australia, who featured Guy Sebastian as their entry. And here's where I think Australia made a tiny error. It's just a small one. They submitted a legitimate artist performing a legitimately excellent song, and they just slightly missed the point of Eurovision.
We don't appear to understand the rules. And he was fantastic. And
he is
a fantastic Australian artist. And it was quite weird when I heard that he was representing us, because he won Australian Idol years ago, maybe 7 years ago now. And he's had a great career, to the point where at the moment it's kind of like Guy Sebastian releases a song and my dad's the sort of person who goes, oh, that's a cool song by that. Have you heard that Guy Sebastian song? And
like, that's how mainstream he is.
Yes, he's a dad artist. And he did a great performance,
I think.
Didn't really hit the nail on the head with being ridiculous enough.
Yeah.
It was too safe. It was safe pop.
Yeah. It wouldn't have been good form to turn up and just completely blast it the first year.
No, that's true. Yeah, they did play it safe in a kind of, we're not sure what to expect from this, so we're just going to kind of dip the toe in the water. But I feel like there is a couple of things that they could have done slightly differently, and that includes things like
ripping his clothes off.
Rip off costume change is a standard Eurovision move. That's one option. The second option is some kind of mad interpretive dance happening with the backing dancers that doesn't really connect in any way to the vocalist. That's a second thing they could have done. And the third thing is to have musicians playing fake instruments on the stage, which is like the perfect Eurovision trifecta. If you can get those three things in one performance, then you've pretty much nailed it.
Can we just think back to last night and see if there was an act that did all of those things? Because I'm thinking of Austria, and I'm thinking of those instruments that they were playing, which they were clearly not.
Yep, correct.
If they had an interpretive dance act on stage, they would have won the trifecta of ridiculousness.
They might have nailed it. There was, I think, a couple of instances of rip-off clothing. Spain did the best job of that by having... Yeah. It wasn't just, I'm going to rip this skirt off and have a tiny outfit underneath. She literally had one dress that entirely was removed and had a completely different dress underneath. I think there was one group, I want to say it was... No, I can't remember who it was now, who did an entire group change of costume, which is actually very impressive as well.
Oh, yes, that was Serbia.
Oh, yeah, and they went disco crazy halfway through.
She was fantastic.
She was just more... the song is called Beauty Never Lies.
Yes.
Not sure about the accuracy of that statement, but nonetheless an excellent track. And I do feel like Serbia were a little bit cheated on the points scoring at the end of the night.
I think so as well. I think, talking about sort of Australian, UK... competition, I am quite happy as an Australian this morning, but I'm aware that you guys just don't try at all.
Yes, that's correct. I think Aisha was labouring under a misapprehension that was us putting effort in.
It's quite difficult to tell the difference between us trying and not trying.
Yes,
because even when we do make a concerted effort, we still come near the bottom of the table.
Yeah, because we have done for the last nearly 20 years. Yes.
Is it just because you're unpopular in Europe? Is it a political thing?
We are unpopular. Most European countries submit people who are genuinely kind of good artists from their country.
Right.
So they do, they like countries like Azerbaijan, Albania, Latvia, Lithuania, they tend to submit people who have legitimately are having hits in their charts in their home countries. Like, that's pretty normal. Whereas in the UK, we pluck people from obscurity and put them on
Eurovision. Well, that was very, very evident last night.
And the last time we won, which was in 1997, was Katrina and the Waves. Which was they were a legitimate band who were already releasing. They hadn't been plucked from obscurity,
and that song stands up.
And that song is an excellent song, and it's a perfect Eurovision song because of the subject matter, which is often the kind of building bridges theme that they kept on going on about last night. They were talking about it like it was a new thing, but that's pretty much always for the last 60 years what Eurovision is about.
It's always centered around that general theme.
And a lot of the time you do find that there are songs that are submitted that have that kind of flavour about building bridges, peace and love, and communicating across countries and across boundaries and that kind of thing. So you'll see quite a lot of that.
Circles are a very, very popular symbol in Eurovision. Everything's circular, just, you know, to keep that circle of life thing.
Yeah, and the kind of all-inclusive feeling that they're trying to emulate. So that's kind of the kind of point of Eurovision. And Australia did a great job. I think, was it seventh in the end? Sixth?
No, fifth.
Fifth? I thought Belgium came fifth.
No, Belgium was incredibly... came fourth. They were great. I love that. I want that guy's album.
Yeah.
Like, I've never watched a song on Eurovision where I've gone, okay, can I get that? More of that music, please?
Yeah, Belgium had a classically wild card entry, which wasn't typical Eurovision in some respects, but actually is the kind of thing that tends to do quite well, because he's probably a pop star who is perhaps popular in other European countries who will have voted for it. And actually, we loved it as well.
Yeah, I wanted him to win, but I was very happy with how he did. I think we're going to have to cut our Eurovision chat short.
We could do a whole show devoted to this, so let's
move on. We could, and I could start talking about how emotional I was last night, watching the opening. It was just, it was a lot of stuff to take in.
I'm glad you came to join us, as in Australia came to join the competition. Yeah. I hope they're there to stay, because it was...
I have a lot of feelings around Eurovision, just all the feelings. Anyway, we're going to move on, and as you know, it is bank holiday weekend, and I'm going to play you a essay by Corey Hulls, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about thinking about how much you might drink this evening and how that could adversely affect your life.
I was recently asked by a co-worker to partake in hashtag Dry January, a month whereby people attempt and hopefully succeed to limit their alcohol drinking to nil for the calendar month. I declined, both because drinking alcohol is something I do that I wholeheartedly enjoy, but moreover, I would hope that if I wanted to stop drinking alcohol, I would hopefully not need a hashtag and the sponsorship of Wander in Finance to do so, despite the positive cause. I've stopped drinking before, but it's not something I would do again in the near future. There's no doubt that while illicit drugs, cigarettes, and even caffeine and sugar have just as many proven health risks as alcohol, all of the former, with mostly good reason, have extremely negative connotations both when brought up in life and media, whereas going out with a group of friends and not drinking will often be met with the same reaction as bringing an illegitimate child to a funeral. However, one thing does interest me about alcohol more than anything else. It is the innate ability to change behaviour, to make people do things they often regret, make them feel worse about themselves both in body and their mind, and cause issues and actions between friends that I believe are most often ignored out of sheer embarrassment. And we all willingly imbibe this poison. But for various reasons, alcohol is here to stay, which is something I'm personally stoked about. So the only thing that we can do, my culturally informed brethren, is to further educate ourselves to the effects of this tonic. So I've laid out the 9 stages of a night out on alcohol, not necessarily in chronological order, as everyone has different tolerance levels. But to make it more easily understandable, I'll be highlighting these stages with 9 real-life popular culture examples. Number 1, the planning stage, embodied by Leslie Knope from Parks and Recreation. The planning it takes to organise a great night out these days is often nothing short of amazing. But by the same token, the best nights out are also crazy, impulsive, and take you on a journey that you think you're in control of, yet it often has other plans for you. At the beginning of a night of drinking, you're Leslie Knope, the bright-eyed, big-planning, yet impulsive, reactive, and emotional hero of Parks and Recreation. You hope all can go your way, that all your dreams can be achieved, but really, without your friends, at this stage, you'll soon find that there is no hope whatsoever. Stage 2, I'm So Excited, embodied by Brandon Stark, episode 1 of Game of Thrones. Look at you! You are so full of life and youthful exuberance. You are so happy to be out and with all your friends. You just want to climb on things. If there's a table to be on top of, you are dancing on it. If there's a street lamp to spin around, you are doing a full revolution. Because you are the second in line to be the future king of the North. And the world is your oyster. And by gum, you're going to shuck it. Stage 3, confusion, embodied by Captain America. When you settle into a night out, and that sweet, sweet alcohol touches your lips, things start to feel different. The physical changes are the smallest of your problems. Things start to taste better, smell better. Members of the opposite sex just look consistently amazing. It is downright confusing. But just like Captain America had to adapt to a world with Furby, Snapchat, and the continued popular culture relevance of Arnold Schwarzenegger, so too must you adapt. Stage 4, It's All Gone Wrong, embodied by contestants on The Amazing Race. Whenever closely laid plans go to waste, things become a shit show, and with just a sprinkling of alcohol, you become exactly akin to the contestants on The Amazing Race. All it takes is one of the group to finish work late so a cab gets cancelled, which in turn misses a dinner reservation, or a train delay, or a person not to get let into a club, or a person to run out of phone battery, etc., etc. The old standard of a butterfly flapping its wings has never been truer than when on a night out drinking, as people can be caught acting so far out of character, racing against some imaginary clock to ensure that the evening is not a disappointment. Watching your group devolve from fun-loving friends to squabbling foes racing through a train station frantically checking restaurant reviews or calling friends begging to be put on a guest list, all while assigning blame with such ferocity that it feels almost odd that you're not doing a piece to camera, is something to behold. Stage 5. Speak to me, don't look at me, embodied by Cyrano de Bergerac. Look at you, Casanova. You've caught it, and it isn't going anywhere. It's the gift of the gab, and goddamn it if it's not Christmas in March. Because that hot piece who you've been eyeing up all night has been left by his or her friends while they retreat in the cold to go smoke a cigarette. A non-smoker. As well as giving him or her the gift of the gab, you make sure you pass on that card to that wedding planner you met at that craft beer festival. Because I'm telling you what, you've checked your calendar, and with smart choices like that, there's 30 days in August 2016 where the long-range weather report indicates that it'll be a nice day for a white wedding. You queue up all your greatest small and medium talk hits like an old Toto jukebox. A conversation with you is like a casual dip in a slowly descending swimming pool. Refreshing. Fun. But they better be careful, because eventually, that shit gets deep. Despite this gab being boxed up, wrapped, and having a bow tied around it, the only problem is, you have never looked worse in your whole life. You still have beer foam on your upper lip. You are sweating absolutely profusely, and the heating is broken in the bar you're at. You have somehow decided that a good look for you would be to drape your sweater over your shoulders and neck like you're on a boat. However, the knot is loosened, and you now appear to have attempted to leave your house in a cape. Your hair is somehow in your mouth, in your nose, and also in the bartender's mouth. And carb loading for a big night ahead with a protein-packed salad has never seemed like a worse idea, with the spinach-to-tooth ratio in your mouth earth-shatteringly in favour of the former. Stage 6. Who are you? Embodied by Tony Soprano's gang from The Sopranos. Depending on how much you've had to drink, around this stage of the evening, it's multiple personality disorder time. And nothing encapsulates this quite frankly scary portion of the evening than the buffoons that make up Tony Soprano's gang. If you've done it right, all three of these guys should make an appearance around the midnight mark of an evening. Character 1, Silvio Dante. Silvio is the most loyal and trusted confidant. At this stage, you are everyone's best friend and a vault of information. Whether it's your best friend of 20 years or the gentleman in the bathroom handing out towels, people have stories to tell and you have two ears. As far as you're concerned, that's a match akin to Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. Character 2, Paulie Walnuts. Horrific looking, poor motor skills, terrible dress sense, and a ludicrously quick to anger. When you drink, you are or have been Paulie Walnuts. Don't lie. Character 3, Christopher Moltisanti. The enigma of the gang, and one of the most confusing of the multiple personalities. Christopher is arrogant, brash, violent, narcissistic, sad, lovable, a hopeless and committed romantic, and often would do anything just to wreck himself in any way, with anything, for all the pain he has caused people in his life. If you find yourself heading too far into this rabbit hole, perhaps head straight to Character 7 and call it a night. Stage 7, feeding time, embodied by Mr. Fusion from Back to the Future 2. While Doc Brown's invention certainly was amazing in its ability to allow for the DeLorean time machine to turn refuse into fuel and allow our heroes to return to 1965, what you were doing with a full plate of Doner meat and chips and an off-licensed beverage in a paper bag is almost the definition of an antonym of heroic. You lie to yourself and say that you are refueling and helping ease the crippling revenge your head will take on your body when you wake up the next morning. But the only thing you are refueling in this case is the poor street cleaner's burning hatred for humanity as he cleans up what remains of your re-nourishment from outside the kebab shop the next morning, presuming you hold it in your system for what would be a record 5 to 10 minute period to make it outside the shop doors. Stage 8, The Descent, embodied by Brandon Stark, episodes 2 to 40. At the beginning of the evening, you are so full of life and zest, but you are now a shadow of your former self. You are being followed by a gargantuan character that you barely know, but seem somewhat reliant on, and for some reason your limbs will not work. Your voice sounds different, you look worse than you have ever looked, if you are honest to yourself, and you can't help but look inside people's minds all around you and see horrible, terrible darkness. Also, your mere existence seems to be driving almost everyone else that is not in your immediate circle of friends to murderous, spite-driven rage, often directed squarely at you. You want to leave these situations you keep finding yourself in, most often caused by your mind-numbing ineptitude and punchable face, but you just can't seem to move. Stage 9, Haze, embodied by any of the characters or indeed the audience members of the film Inception. You stumble around for what feels like hours on end, not asleep, not awake. Mortal people glide by you in what feels like a haze, their ghostly residue sticking at your feet like the trail of a world's biggest snail. Time is absolutely relative to your current situation, but anyway, as you ask yourself and several members of the early morning church attending public, if we are all made of stars and the universe is a flat circle, does time even exist? Pepper spray stings, it turns out. All you have is your phone and Google Maps, a totem that anchors you to the streets that seem familiar to you, yet there is something slightly off about them. At least there must be. It doesn't usually take you 2 hours to walk from the corner of the street to your door. Concurrently falling asleep and forward motion is not a miracle, it turns out, but a must if you were to find what you were looking for, whether it be bed, the wallet you dropped when you got out of the cab, or the macaroni and cheese you left in the oven, but thought might pair well with a Snickers and some vodka and Fanta, which if the sun peeking over the hills is any indicator, could be a considerable amount past al dente. Christian Bale once said, "It's the actors who are prepared to make fools of themselves who are usually the ones who come to mean something to an audience." And of course, it was the Bard himself who stated that all the world is in fact a stage. So the next time you feel any twinge of guilt or reticence about going out for a drink, consider the characters you'll play, the roles you'll inhabit. Consider the joy you'll bring the people around you, and think of just how much personal growth this will bring you as a person when done right. Ask yourself, can you really afford not to have a drink tonight?
Going on from that, I will be having a drink tonight, but I will not be getting up to stage 9, if you just listen to that, then you'll know what I mean. That was a essay by Corey Holes called The 9 Stages of Drinking. Coming up now, we are going to play a pre-record of a review that Richard Stratton has done for us. Richard Stratton is a Blackshaw person who is an actor and also wrote our latest production of Alice in Wonderland. He is very talented, and we all went and saw Carmen Disruption at the Almeida Theatre. So this is Richard Stratton talking about Carmen Disruption.
After entering the theatre via the backstage area and catching a glimpse of a daunted-looking Carmen through the door of her dressing room, you find yourself walking across the stage and into the auditorium of what looks like a derelict opera house. The remnants of a grand passer scattered around, and a large deceased bull lies prone in the centre of the stage. This was the beginning of Carmen Disruption, a new play by Simon Stevens at the Almeida Theatre. Not being much of an opera fan, I hadn't seen or really knew anything about the original opera the play is based on, but a deep knowledge wasn't needed to engage with it, and my ignorance didn't affect my enjoyment of the piece, which comprises of 5 separate stories that spiral in on one each other until finally colliding. Each story is told by a character trapped in a situation they want out of, and follows their attempts to escape, each with varying levels of success. The characters roam around an unspecified European city and comprise of an opera singer who's trapped in a never-ending cycle of touring the same character, a businessman trapped in a never-ending succession of hotels, business trips, and who has lost a lot of money on a deal that's gone sour, a rent boy whose self-worth is so tied up in being wanted and desired he defends an abusive client, a taxi driver who's in debt to a man her ex-husband owed money to and must do a favour to clear it, and finally, a student obsessed with her ex-boyfriend and university tutor. As each of these stories plays out, the spectre of Carmen moves among them, singing parts of the original score and also some lyrics that complement the story of the characters she watches over. This makes for an interesting mix of the traditional opera and a modern twist with modern lyrics. This isn't the only nod to the play's operatic roots. Fantastic use is made of a surtitle screen. Traditionally used to display translations of lyrics, in Carmen Disruption it's used to show everything from messages to flight information and is superbly employed throughout. The performances were universally fantastic and the ensemble effortlessly moved from story to story, never drawing your attention away from one another while they became background characters for their fellow performers. It was only a shame that they didn't all get equal time to tell their stories. The student and taxi driver in particular I would have liked to have heard more from, and felt a little shortchanged that I didn't. At times, with the stories weaving in and out from one another, it took me a second to remember where they had last left us in their own story, and that did disrupt the flow for me. By the end of the performance, some characters had escaped from what was trapping them, some could at least see a way out, and some were back where they started at the beginning. As a spectator, the path we're led down to get to the play's suitably operatic conclusion is dizzying and sometimes overwhelming, but don't let this put you off. It's an ambitious and finely tuned piece of theatre that demands nothing but its audience's full attention, and it fully deserves it.
That was Richard Stratton reviewing Carmen Disruption, which is on at the Alameda Theatre in Islington at the moment. I went and saw it. I found it quite a lot to take in. I didn't really know anything about it going into it, and I am aware that it's based on an opera, which I'm not a great fan of, and I was a little bit worried when I found out about this about that in the foyer.
You're not a fan of that opera or of opera?
Of opera, just as a general rule. So when I found out it was based on an opera in the foyer, I was like, okay, there better not be any opera singing in this, and there was, but it was okay. It wasn't over the top or anything. It fit in with the rest of the play really well, and it was beautifully done. Like, the set was fantastic. Richard just spoke about in that review about the giant bull that was dead on the stage, which was breathing at the time of the throughout the play. Its chest was moving, and it was just one of those nice little subtle things that you sort of noticed halfway through. The set was fantastic. There was a lot going on. And I did enjoy it, but I did find it quite hard to deal with at times. Just, I came out sort of thinking that I'd missed a lot of it, and I did, I think, was the general consensus. Everyone was like, oh, yeah, this happened. And I was like, did it? Oh, okay. That's just me. That's got nothing to do with the quality of the theatre that it was. It's just me being a little bit uncultured and not really understanding some things, I think.
Yeah, I didn't see this, but I feel like you can always count on the Almeida to be... just be pushing things a little bit and be a bit experimental and a bit challenging.
It was that. It was, and that's the thing. It wasn't bad, and it wasn't that I came out of it being like, oh, that sucked because it made me feel stupid. It was a very challenging play to watch, and the performances were out of control. Like, they were so, so good and so emotive that got it over the line for me, because I was like, it made me feel a lot of things. Hated the ending, though. Just going to throw that out there. we spoke the last time that we were on air, Matt, that you were going to see, it was actually Election Day.
It was,
the last
I went to see, what was it even called? Light Shining in Buckinghamshire.
Yes, that's the one.
The new Carol Churchill play at the National. And yes, I booked it so many months in advance, and it just happened to work out. It wasn't a political act that I went to see it on election night, but that's the way it happened. I say new Carol Churchill, I heard somewhere she's been writing this or trying to write it for a good 30 years or so. And I don't know. I do like Carol Churchill. I've liked a lot of her work in the past. I didn't think this was sort of vintage her. It's got a few of her hallmarks, that kind of really snappy dialogue with everybody sort of biting over each other, but only in a couple of scenes. It has quite sort of an interesting episodic structure at the beginning. Sorry, I should say it's about the sort of the fallout in the aftermath of the English Civil War, sort of the Putney debates and the formation of government after that. So it's sort of the way it does the war is quite interesting in a kind of an episodic style, and the debates are done quite well. They're very sort of political polemic, and it is people standing and talking, but manages not to be too dull with that. And the set is amazing. It's a massive dining table with sort of all the aristocracy sitting all around it, and the king at the head, and all the poor scrapping around on the table while the aristocracy sort of eat their dinners. It's the look of it is just fantastic.
Wow.
But it was just a bit, it veered over from episodic into disjointed from me, and the second half I felt dragged quite a lot. I don't know. I'm not sure about whether the 30-year production process has taken its toll on that one.
Potentially, maybe it's been overworked slightly.
It was good to see debates about democracy on election night, though.
Yeah. That's
and it kept me from me away from the election coverage.
Yes, the less said about that, the better, I think. Is that still on at the moment, Matt?
I believe it is. Yes, yeah, it's running for a little while yet.
If you want to go and see Carmen Disruption as well, that is running up until the 23rd of May at the Almeida Theatre in Islington, and tickets are ranging from £9 to £36. Now we're going to talk a little bit about something that we're doing, that we have done. So in the time that we've been off of the air, we have finished our run of Alice in Wonderland at the Battersea Library in Clapham. And excitingly, we have secured a transfer to the Streatham Festival on the 4th and 5th of July. And that's going to be taking at the British Home, which is apparently I've not seen the venue, but apparently it is beautiful. And tickets for Alice, the next run of Alice, will be on sale soon. If you want to go to blackshoreonline.com, you can get tickets. You can also follow us at Blackshore Update. And just to get you in the mood for Alice again, we are going to play some interviews with the cast.
Mr. Wickenden, you're going to have to come away from that fan if I want to speak to you, because it causes a bit of a disturbance. Steve, he's sitting down in an interview chair. Fantastic.
I'm very
well
old.
Done, Steve.
Sit down. I'm very achy.
Okay, so you're playing a librarian and the Queen of Hearts. How do you feel about the two different characters that you have to play?
Well, it's fun. They're kind of. It's nice to play two different aspects of your own character, and put it out, because the librarian's definitely sort of the grumpy, miserable side of me, and then you know the queen obviously being the sort of extravagant, over the top. So that's always good.
So you get to really like amp up two sides of your
absolutely. Yeah, I just play myself.
Yeah,
two extremes.
Two extremes.
Which is basically how I've conned my way into becoming an actor over the last half many years, just playing parts that are a bit like me,
a bit extravagant.
Yeah,
because you're new to the team.
Yes, new to the show. Yes.
Did you feel any like hostility?
Yeah, everyone was really horrible.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No, that's
I've not made any friends, few enemies, but it's been really nice actually. It's always a bit daunting coming into a production that you know has happened before,
yeah.
And you know, especially when a lot of the original cast are in it and you're replacing somebody, so you have that sort of feeling of, oh, you know, am I doing as good a job as the first person did? But then at the same time I was really reluctant to find out too much about how the parts have been played before, because the only real way that you can do it is to come into it and just do your thing and do something totally different with it.
Absolutely.
Which I think I probably have.
Yeah, I think
given that it was actually an actual woman that got to play it, a real bona fide woman.
Yeah.
So of course it's going to be really different, but then that's nice. And I think it's sort of nice for everybody else that's involved as well, because obviously, you know, as nice as it would have been to have all the original cast as well, you get a couple of new people along, it sort of changes it a little
freshens it up,
makes it a bit of a different performance
and of course the new space
is great actually. Mm. And unfortunately, because we are only on radio, you can't see. But it's the most. It means you have to come and see the show.
Yeah,
but it's great. It's really incredible. And actually, the more time you spend here, the more little things you find, little spaces you find. And so it's going to be good this afternoon doing it, actually doing the tech and finding all the different things that we can do as performers in the space. And also the things that we can't do that we thought, oh, that was going to be really easy, and that's not. No, I've already highlighted a couple of things. I'm like, yeah,
it's
I can't do that
really
now.
Yeah, there's a lot of distance to travel for certain people. Yourself
well, actually, I was talking to Emily, who's playing Alice earlier, and when we've been rehearsing the first scene of the show, where it's Alice and the librarian, and we'd practiced this, you know, her sort of walk into the door, and the distance now between the librarian's desk and the door is just going to have to hike across it. The audience is going to have to sort of go. So it's all those little things that you think in rehearsal have been really easy.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you go, oh, actually, no, we need to tweak that. So that's going to be this afternoon. It should be fun.
Cool. Yeah. We look forward to it.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I'm now talking to Tegan, who is diligently folding bunting. How are you finding the whole process?
Very fun, enjoyable. A lot of paper and cardboard. And diamonds and PVA and newspaper. Yeah.
So it feels a little bit like Blue Peter.
Yeah.
It's theatrical Blue Peter.
Exactly. That's really what it is. Apart from, I'm not getting a Blue Peter badge. But
you're not. Are you getting any sort of Blackshaw badge?
I hope so, you know. I think that in the end I might be able to achieve one of these, but, you know, I've just got to wait and see, you know. See if I can impress the
team enough.
Yeah, impress the team enough.
Yeah, so how, I mean, because this is the first time you've worked with Blackshaw, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
How are you finding all that? Not wishing to put you on the spot.
No, very fun. Very friendly. I wasn't expecting it to be as fun and like chilled and like a, I don't know, coming from uni and never having done a show outside of uni. It's quite similar actually in a good way, and it's really like a little family and everybody chips in and everything. Yeah. So it's really nice and I've been having a great time.
Oh, good.
Putting everything in my car and driving everything around in London. But it's been great. Thank you.
Well, I'll let you get on with your bunting and
thank
I shall
you.
Wander
thank
off.
You very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. We're going to talk to Rosie Marsh first. How are you, Rosie?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, good. How are you finding today so far?
Today, it's been pretty exciting. So we're in the actual space for the first time, which is really nice. So it's been really good to see everything and see how it's going to work and just excited to get going now, really.
Cool. Have you enjoyed the rehearsal process?
I have, yeah. It's been really, really fun. And it's such a great play anyway. It's so much fun to do and to play around with and sort of discovering all the characters and stuff and seeing what everyone else has done. It's been a really, really fun process.
Cool. How are you finding playing the Mad March Hare?
It's slightly schizophrenic at times because I'm the March Hare and the Dormouse at the same time, so that can kind of mess with my head a little bit as to who I actually am, but the two characters are so extravagant and over the top that they've been a real joy to play, actually. They've been really good fun, although they absolutely exhaust me. I kind of come out of it a shell of my former self because I just put so much energy into them. But
Marvellous. So, what are you looking forward to the most, do you think?
I don't know, but do you know what? I think it's probably just going to be... I think I'm really excited about the first performance now, about putting it in front of people, because we've spent, you know, quite a long time now doing it to each other and, you know, showing our different scenes and stuff. But you just never know what the audience reaction... Hopefully good.
Yeah.
But you never know what the reaction's going to be.
Hopefully no one's just going to burst into tears.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully we don't have any... You never know. I have had that situation before, but with a child, not just some grown audience member. Yeah, I wasn't that bad. So that should be really good. I'm excited about that.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. I'll let
thank
you get
you.
On.
Thank you.
That was Alexander Pankhurst interviewing members of the Alice in Wonderland cast And those members were Steve Wickenden, who plays the librarian and the Queen of Hearts. And it was Rosie Marsh, who plays the Mad March Hare and the Dormouse. And also one of our stage manager, Tegan Cutts, who did a fantastic job in the run of Alice that we've just finished a couple of weeks ago. That is getting a transfer to the Streatham Festival on the 4th and the 5th of July. So if you missed it in this run, then you can go and see it in July. It's perfect. Yay. Excitingly as well, in Blackshaw News, we are turning 5 years old on Friday.
We were tempted to make this show just an entire hour of us blowing party squeakers.
Yeah, but we decided
and singing
maybe
happy birthday over and over.
Popping champagne corks everywhere, but then we thought maybe you'd want actual radio content instead.
No one wants to hear.
Don't say we never do anything for you.
Yeah, exactly. We've sacrificed people. We have sacrificed.
So yes, we are celebrating our 5th birthday on Friday, and that is also bringing us to the end of the show. Thank you very much, Matt and Vicky, for joining me. Matt is going to be back in a couple of weeks' time, but I think in a fortnight, when we are back on the air on Sunday from 6 till 7, we'll be playing part one of Audience with the Ghost Finder, which is our first ever Blackshaw-produced radio play, which Matt wrote.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. So stay tuned for that in the next coming weeks. That is on the 7th of June that we will be back on the radio. But I guess that's goodbye.
That's it. Yeah. Have a great bank holiday weekend, everybody.
Yeah, enjoy your Monday off.